Thank you all for being here this evening. And I know many of you have been sitting Sesshin last weekend. And I must say, sometimes when I come back in the Zendo, even though I wasn't here, I feel like you can feel the energy of Sesshin. And particularly with the light changing, it's bona fide dark right now, which I always find a little bit alarming, but it comes with the fall. So I'm very mindful that there's a cake somewhere in the house. And that basically I'm standing between the rest of you and cake. So I'll try to keep this short, and I want to talk a little bit about staying and leaving. So apropos to our friends, Hannah and Chuck and Nanette, I'm very much reminded, as I'm sure you all are too, that that a goodbye is always part of life. And that the changes that Chuck and Nanette and Hannah have been experiencing and planning for, leaving Santa Cruz and moving to new homes, and our changes in their individual lives that also kind of ripple out in our community. I actually was going to say reverberate, but since you already said reverberate, I feel I can't do that. So, and we adjust to these changes by appointing new Enos, and priests are stepping in to take the Doshi slots that Hannah has been doing. And I say this not to suggest that you three are replaceable, although we did just replace you. But actually, what I want to clarify is that what they do in terms of roles is always replaceable, because that's the function of what we do here in terms of training and the next generation of students. But what is not replaceable is are your own unique contributions to the Sangha. Sometimes I think the word that I'd like to use to talk about that is what I would call your own individual suchness. So there is, you'll have to kind of join me later outside over tea and cake to kind of clarify what that suchness is, but I do think there is such a thing as a Chuck suchness, a Hannah-ness, and a Nanette-ness that are all a form of suchness. And I also want to acknowledge that the three of you have made, like from 36,000 feet, it just seems like you guys are leaving and going to a new place, and you made different life choices, but I think it's not revealing any state secrets to say that these are always tough choices, and that you leave behind people that you love, like us. But I'm also thinking of your families and your grandchildren, and that as you move to your new places, that there's both kind of a letting go and new promise for the life that you're about to take up. This arising and letting go, changing, passing away, all of this is just the nature of our lives. And as hard as it is to accept, it's inevitable. Not necessarily that you three go, but that we all have this in our lives. So we may not all move, although who knows, you may start a little exodus to Upaya or to Berkeley. But this is part of the Dharma of being a human. So one of the major teachings of this lineage of Buddhism is that this body and mind is unique in a certain way, which is to say that the conditions and the causes that have given rise to the way we live, our choices in families, partners, practice, places, and all of that, all of this is very specific to us individually. So my own karmic formations are different than Adrian's, are different than Ken's, are different than Kathy's, and so on. And to be sure, we share these very gross similarities, and that, you know, whatever it is, old age, sickness, death, suffering, all of these we share in various forms, even though they take very specific kinds of formations in our lives. And but the specific karmic formation that is, for example, Dana or Patrice, is what this one very kind of well-known Zen master, who's often quoted by the Soto Zen lineage, but is probably more well-known in the Rinzai lineage, Yun Men. He calls this our inner light. And Yun Men was, when he uses this term inner light or our light, he's really talking about the foundation for enlightenment experiences. And everyone has that inner light. And what Yun Men is notable for is saying that everyone has their own light, and if you want to see it, you can't. The darkness is dark, dark. And he poses this somewhat kind of rhetorical, but it's a teaching device question, that in which he asks, what is your light? And for Yun Men, a person's light is not within the reach of our senses. So the eyes, nose, ears, tongue, and so on, are not the avenues by which we reach this light. And nor do we reach it simply by studying texts, although certainly we do that. In fact, in preparation for today, I always have this kind of anxiety, like, what shall I talk about? What books shall I cite? So I pull about 20 out, and they're all kind of folded over one another. And honestly, at least for me, I mean, other people may have a different experience of this, it's actually better if I don't look at the books. But that's partly my academic training, and partly a little bit of nervousness, and partly just kind of my reliance on things outside this one. So while awareness of our sense aggregates is helpful, the practice is to basically be in the dark. So as we are now in practice period, we're headed into this period of great change in the light, great coming and going. Being in this darkness is what we do when we face the wall. And we do this collectively, but our own karmic formations are what's up in front of us when we're sitting zazen. And the idea is, and of course this is a somewhat kind of theoretical proposition, but the promise of our practice is that this is true, that by sitting in this darkness, self-awareness becomes an awareness of no self. Mind and object merge. Inside and outside become one, and realization occurs. Sounds simple, doesn't it? It's not really that simple. I've been doing this for 17 years. It's a struggle. But it's a good struggle, and it's one that we share collectively. So I just want to say a little bit about Yun Men. He's this really salty monk. And I'm sure actually Netsi probably does koans with Yun Men. We read about him in the Book of Equanimity. Dogen cites him. Suzuki Roshi cites him often. He's also, I think, in the Blue Cliff Record, and so on. And he's very figurative in the Rinzai tradition, and he's also figurative in Zen. In fact, there's a whole school known as the Yun Men School of Zen, Buddhism in China. And if you like, you can go read those texts, because they're all available. And if you don't have them, you can borrow them from me, because they're all on my desk right now. Open to the appropriate page. So, you know, one of the ways that we learn about the ancient masters is we read their koans. which is a very kind of fundamental part of the Rinzai tradition, which is, you know, not just Rinzai, but we also study koans here in Zen, the Soto Zen. And we also sometimes read or refer to the great master's transmission stories or enlightenment stories. And I just want to read you this one passage, mostly because it amuses me, or I find it amusing. I think there's a modern-day version of these transmission stories. Did I get this from you? Okay, so this is, there are lots of, summaries of the transmission or enlightenment stories of our ancestral lineage. And this is one that comes from Andy Ferguson. This is his book, Zen's Chinese Heritage. So Yunmen had two teachers, and this is his first enlightenment with a teacher named Bu Zhou. And it goes like this. When Bu Zhou heard Yunmen coming, he closed the door to his room. Yunmen knocked on the door. Bu Zhou says, "Who is it?" Yunmen says, "It's me." Bu Zhou says, "What do you want?" And Yunmen says, "I'm not clear about my life. I'd like the master to give me some instruction." Bu Zhou then opened the door and, taking a look at Yunmen, closed it again. So Yunmen knocked on the door in this manner 3 days in a row. On the third day, when Bu Zhou opened the door, Yunmen stuck his foot in the doorway. Bu Zhou grabbed Yunmen and yelled, "Speak! Speak!" And when Yunmen began to speak, Bu Zhou gave him a shove and said, "Too late." And he then slammed the door, catching and breaking Yunmen's foot. At that moment, Yunmen experienced enlightenment. Sounds painful, huh? I think there's like a Facebook version of this. Yunmen tries to friend Bu Zhou, and Bu Zhou says, "No." And then he does it again, and Bu Zhou says, "No." And he does it a third time, and Bu Zhou, I don't know, puts a picture of a broken foot on Yunmen's Facebook page. And we are left as students of Zen to think about what it is that occurred there and why Yunmen experienced enlightenment when he got his foot caught in the door and broken, his leg broken. And a contemporary teacher, Daido Luri, has talked about Yunmen as kind of shattering the intellect or our intellectual understanding of enlightenment and sitting in the dark or with the dark. And he has this to say. I also thought this was fairly amusing. He says, at one point, this is Daido Luri speaking, at one point in my training at Zen Center of Los Angeles, I was instructing some people on liturgy. Somebody was asking a lot of questions, and I was going to give them some practical information and fill them with data. As I started, I heard Mayazumi Roshi, my teacher, roar behind me, "That's not what liturgy is." I just want you to know this is all of our biggest fear. That you're explaining something, maybe an intro to Zen or something, and Kokyo or Jean or Patrick comes up and says, "What are you doing? That's not correct." So this is Daido Luri continuing. He snatched everything away from the student and from me. What's really going on in liturgy? What's really going on when we invoke during invocation? Bodhidharma said, invoking is not done with the voice, it's done with the mind. What does it mean to invoke with the mind? How does such mind manifest? Only the wondrousness of the mystery remains. We should enter here. How? The commentary continues. An old master once said, the spiritual light shines alone for transcending the senses. This light, the mystery, is not even approachable, says Daido Luri, through the senses. It's not approachable because it's not a physical reality. By definition, the mystery is intangible, not even palpable, undiscussable, and it doesn't arrive from the outside. It's a teaching that in reality has no teacher. That means you already have it. And the only thing that any teacher can do is take away the things that you construe as the mystery. When all the definitions are taken away, then the mystery itself remains, and you discover it for yourself. The mystery can't be taken away. It's already there. The spiritual light shines alone for transcending the senses. Yun Men has snatched the senses away from you. Are you willing to trust and enter the mystery? All it takes is that trust. So as I think about the three of you leaving, I think, oh, well, there's a certain amount of trust going on here, right? That you've made these life choices, that you're leaving us. But that these are decisions that are hard won through sitting in the dark. That is your own unique karmic formations. And we are all, I think, operating here on the promise of our practice, that we can find that trust, that we may enter the mystery, that we trust the very human condition of continuous change in our lives. And as many of you know, all of us, I think, and we often don't talk about this, except in very kind of general terms, over tea or maybe at Sangha Day or maybe at morning circle or after a Zazen period, about the changes that occur in our lives. But I trust that everyone here is working on something. Very few people come to Zen because they're completely blissed out. Usually we have something that we're worried about, that we're concerned about, the past, the future, whether it's a relationship or family or work or whatever, we're all pretty much working on something. And even though we're smiling and laughing about it, we're working pretty hard at that. So this continuous nature of change in our lives is, I think, what kind of undergirds and also connects us. And one of the ways that I think Daido Lori is teaching us about this through Yun Men's teaching is to say that a lot of this is not really discussable, even though I'm sitting here trying to discuss it with you right now. But I'm about to end that. So as many of you know, my dad passed away about a month ago. Still kind of, I want to say difficult for me to discuss, especially in front of such a large group of people. But he fell, and when he went into hospice, and I kind of watched this decline, I thought, I need some of that. I'm wondering about this trust that we have in this darkness. And, most of us face this when our family members die alone. And I took up this practice of chanting. And one of the things that I was chanting was this, it's a Dharani, and it's called the Shosanyo Kichijo Dharani. We don't chant it, do we chant it here? Not in the mornings.
Not often, yeah.
You know, the Dharanis are kind of a different kettle of fish. The other Dharani that you would be familiar with would be the Daihishin Dharani, which we do, I think, every Sunday night. And normally when someone is ill, we chant the Enmeijuku Kanan-gyo, the protecting life. And there was something that wasn't quite right about that as I sat in my own dark with this. And so I did something a little bit different, which was to regularly chant the Shosanyo. And for those of you who, excuse me, I'm going to have like an embarrassing drip here. I need to attend to it. For those of you that are familiar with this, this is a Dharani for removing hindrances. And it's a little bit different than a well-being ceremony, which is for things to get better or for someone to be well. To me, it was a very subtle difference, but it was an important one. And this was a liturgy really for removing hindrances, my own, my father's, and other members of my family, his partner, and the caregivers. Because as you know, when someone is ill and dying, if you're lucky, there's a lot of care that's given, whether it be nurses or caregivers or hospice chaplains and so on. And it was a really, in the end, a really beautiful thing. And I don't know that the Dharani had, I mean, I can't say that that was useful, except that I felt it was useful. And it was part of my own process with my father. And I should also say, I didn't do this with all the caregivers there, because after my dad died, all the caregivers went on about how God had taken my father and I should be grateful. And, you know, I appreciated the feeling of it, but I knew that kind of the removing of hindrances was really important, both for me and my dad. There's another part of Dito Lori's commentary in which he says, you know, really what we're afraid of is we're afraid of life and we're afraid of death. And I think when we're in that place where you're with someone that you love who's dying, or even if you don't love them, you're with someone, you see that kind of tremendous intimacy that arises. And it's a very beautiful thing. So I'm going to close tonight by reading a poem by one of my favorite poets, Jane Hirschfield. And this is a poem called The Promise, and it's about staying, and it's about leaving. And there's no enlightenment in here, but I hope you like this. This is from Jane's new book, and it's called Come Thief. So this is the promise. Stay, I said, to the cut flowers. They bowed their heads lower. Stay, I said to the spider who fled. Stay, leaf. It reddened, embarrassed for me and itself. Stay, I said to my body. It sat, as a dog does, obedient for a moment, soon starting to tremble. Stay, to the earth of riverine valley meadows, of fossiled escarpments, of limestone and sandstone. It looked back with a changing expression and silence. Stay, I said to my loves, and each answered, always. Do you want to hear it again? Once more? What's not to like about Jane Hirschfield, huh? Stay, I said to the cut flowers. They bowed their heads lower. Stay, I said to the spider who fled. Stay, leaf. It reddened, embarrassed for me and itself. Stay, I said to my body. It sat as a dog does, obedient for a moment, soon starting to tremble. Stay, to the earth of riverine valley meadows, of fossil escarpments, of limestone and sandstone. It looked back with a changing expression in silence. Stay, I said to my loves, and each answered, always. Sweet, isn't it? So, let's see, what time is it? I suppose we could have one or two questions, or we could just proceed out and have cake. You know, I don't know that I can be so good about describing exactly what the hindrance was. Of course, on my part, you know, even when you know someone's going to die, when it's actually going on, it's a totally different thing. And I know that, you know, my father had Alzheimer's or dementia for about 6 years. So it was a little bit like you lose someone bit by bit when that happens. And I sensed in him, and I don't know if this is true. I think it's really hard to know what someone else is feeling or what they're perceiving. But I sensed in him fear about dying. And I don't know if that was my fear or his, but I'm not even quite sure where this came from. I wanted those hindrances to be out of the way so that when it came time, he could go. And I don't know, I mean, there's some people in here who have had some chaplaincy training or near chaplaincy training, and I just know from hearing hospice nurses and caregivers talk about people that are dying that, you know, you see everything, you know, and kind of a whole range of people appear to be going downhill and then they pop back up. And I saw my dad go through that several times, and I know he was unhappy about it. I used to go see him. And even when he had dementia, he would say to me, "I'm just waiting to die." And, you know, it's a very helpless feeling because, you know, my father was a very active person who really valued his mind, and having sort of lost his cognitive abilities, I think, was painful for him. And so his words for that were, "I'm waiting to die." Or he would say with some amount of disgust, "Still here." And I don't know, you know, as a kid, what you're supposed to say to that, except, okay, we'll work with that. So, I don't, does that answer your...
Yeah, thank
you. Yeah. Did you experience this when you're...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Would anyone else like to... So in this staying and leaving, I know many of us have our individual goodbyes to say to Nanette-ness and Chuck-ness and Hannah-ness. So why don't we go outside and have cake? Thank you. Being star.